You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. As well, you can hear these podcasts at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. There are two publishing houses, SteinerBooks.org in America and RudolfSteinerPress.com in England, which are the sole publishers of Steiner into English and have given me permission to do these recordings. Please consider patronizing them as well. This is a reading of Collected Works, Volume 213 by Rudolf Steiner, 13 Lectures, entitled Human Questions and Cosmic Answers, translated by Elizabeth Marshall. This is Lecture 12, given in Dornach on the 21st of July, 1922. The last few lectures here were dedicated to a discussion of how we should conceive of modern consciousness. In the last one, I tried to reach back to earlier times and to point out how what now lives in people's souls has been in preparation for a long time within Occidental civilization. Today I would like to pick out various episodes from the immediate present to draw your attention to how a spiritual life has, of necessity, to develop out of the general consciousness of our times, a necessity emerging from the evolution of humanity. We can say that wherever we observe human beings in modern civilization, whether in the West, in the Middle, or in the East, wherever we look more closely, it becomes clear that without the introduction of a spiritual impulse, things cannot move on. Today we want to look at the last 50 years of intellectual spiritual development in Central Europe, through what characterizes the beginning and the end of this period, and thus to prepare for the lectures tomorrow and the day after. I want to do this symptomatically. I want to characterize various points for the beginning and for the end of these 50 years. If we go back to approximately the start of the 1870s, then we find various intellectual spiritual phenomena, which show us the state of the human soul at the time. I want to highlight some of these phenomena. Around 1872, 1873, we have a sensational work of fiction, which closely reflects the times. Younger people now will have forgotten all about this, but the novel that I mean is in fact one that 50 years ago seized people's attention in a quite drastic way. I mean titled Children of the World by Paul Heyse. Paul Heyse was a famous novelist of the time, and with this book he wanted to depict the lives of a number of characters who are all steeped in a certain indeterminate religiosity, but at the same time are all lapsed from any formal religious denominations. So Paul Heyse wanted to contrast what he calls, in rather old-fashioned terminology, to my mind, the children of God with the children of the world, who belonged to no particular confession, who were, as they expressed it at the time, non-denominational, but who still tended to be drawn to the religious. Now, I do not intend to speak much about the novel itself, but to point out how such a work portraying non-religious people made such an impression at the time. I have often spoken to you about my old friend and teacher, Carl Julius Schroer. One of his interests was the study of intellectual phenomena as they affected social life in general. And so Carl Julius Schroer characterized the influence of Paul Heyse's title, Children of the World, by saying that it was extremely odd how at the time, 50 years ago, this novel did the rounds, how everyone was interested in it, and how through this novel people noticed something they would never have thought about before, that they also had distanced themselves from a positive religious commitment, that even though they might still be searching for a religious faith, this was not restricted to any religious denomination. And what was especially interesting was Schroer's observation at the time that people who had taken part in the religious rituals of their church up until then, who out of habit had joined in the old rituals and customs of their church, these people discovered that the novel expressed their inner convictions. And Schroer added that in the face of such a phenomenon, religious controversies seemed like an anachronism, like something which was no longer part of the present, meaning the beginning of the 1870s, because people had already gone beyond this in their thinking. But even though all this is valid, we still have to say that despite having lost all connection to established faiths, the people described in the novel, nevertheless, had the tendency to search for some kind of religiosity. However, they cannot find anything. They go about the world with no faith. They are unable to find any connection to the spiritual world through religious feeling. If we now move on from this fictional literary phenomenon to the lecture theaters, then we find that, at just about the same time, the opinions of many people in scientific life were expressed by Dubois Raymond in the lecture I have often mentioned, titled Limits of Our Knowledge of Nature. In this famous lecture given by Dubois Raymond in 1872, he argues that a fact is only proven when we examine nature through experiment and observation and come to a kind of mathematical, mechanical thinking about the edifice of the world, a kind of mechanism, an atomic mechanism of the edifice of the world. Science cannot go beyond this perception of the world. All else must be left to faith. However, if we had asked someone who spoke like this at the beginning of the 1870s, someone like Dubois Raymond in his title Limits of Our Knowledge of Nature, if we had asked them how people should search for a religious way to the spiritual world, there would have been no answer. They would just have said something similar to the characters in Paul Heise's title Children of the World, who were portrayed as non-denominational. Now it has to be said that the people of those times who took part in what is called cultural life, who had absorbed some of the scientific worldview and adopted some of the ideas permeating the age, all had more or less the same kind of mood. Whether or not they practiced their old religious faith depended on their customary way of life, on their prejudices, and so on. It was not dependent on strict adherence to what their souls had absorbed through the culture of the age. The people of these last 50 years lived in an uncertain, unstable relationship with the spiritual world. We can also find this uncertainty in other areas of life. A few years before the publication of Heise's Children of the World and Dubois Raymond's Limits of Our Knowledge of Nature, the well-known writer Hermann Grimm published, titled Invincible Forces, also a novel. He depicts class prejudices and class differences within Occidental civilization as invincible forces. And, interestingly in this novel, he contrasts the class differences of Occidental civilization with what has developed out of a certain ahistorical and unusual situation in America, as a life not having to contend with these class differences and prejudices. And it is interesting how at the end of the 1860s, also just about half a century ago, Hermann Grimm describes how despite all their liberalism and all their humanism, the European people lack the strength to overcome these class differences. These are for him invincible forces. If we go deeper and ask ourselves why such things are invincible forces for Europeans, then the answer must inevitably be that their thinking has become passive. This thinking that I have characterized, for example, as I spoke about Richard Valla, as reaching only as far as, in quotes, events, and refusing to look into the determining factors behind them, which means wanting to apprehend only the phenomena, not the forces. This thinking has dominated the leading minds of the last 50 years. With such a thinking, which contains no forces, but is merely thinking in feeble thought images, with such a thinking, we are simply not able to overcome what exists in reality as class differences and class prejudices. To be able to overcome them, we would need a thinking steeped in reality, a thinking permeated by reality. And this thinking permeated by reality, which actually created class differences in the old days, which created all of our society in the old days, this dynamic thinking, in contrast to mere descriptive thinking, has declined in the last 50 years within European civilization. it has declined in science, which is why it is now based only on observation and experiment. It has also declined in life, so that people just continue to think in the old conventions, deriving from class prejudices. They did not bother to think any further. For if they had tried to think further, they would have needed an active form of thinking. And, as the proletarian class began to think about class differences, class distinctions, even this feeble thinking, which has no dynamism, was abandoned. They said that class differences have nothing to do with the forces in human thinking. They are completely dependent on economic physical forces. They just drew the obvious conclusion. So there you have what 50 years ago was the starting point of modern intellectual spiritual life. And now I would like to show you a work that appeared just recently and which again is typical of our times, titled Mirror Man by Werfel. Here you have something born out of the forces of our times, in a similar way to how children of the world or invincible forces were born out of their times 50 years ago. Now, what is the situation today confronting people such as Werfel? In the last decades, this feeble, impotent thinking has been in the ascendant. People had been searching for a connection to the religious, to the spiritual world, but there was nothing. However, human nature cannot remain so one-sided. It can remain so for about 50 years in the development of the world, but then human nature starts to react. So if we confine ourselves to the last 50 years, we see that people struggled to find something more powerful than the feeble, impotent thinking of the times. Now many works of the present day are evidence of the striving for a more powerful understanding of reality, particularly, however, this Mirror Man by Werfel. This Mirror Man by Werfel forces you to speak about the present as follows. People have sought long enough, in a feeble and impotent way, to find something that makes a human being fully human. Now a vague inner sense of making itself felt, a sense that along those paths where people have been searching for the last 50 years, and which are not really paths at all but slippery slopes, where you are always falling over, that on these slippery slopes there is nothing to be found. We have to get more iron into our blood again. Mirror Man is a result of this kind of aspiration. I will just describe in a few words what this Mirror Man is all about. It is not my intent to criticize the artistic aspect, but that is not the point, and as we will see, what I have to say also applies to this artistic aspect. We see an immature human being who has grown tired of the life of the world as it is now lived. He takes his leave of this outward life, and his aim now is to become a human being. He admits to himself that in ordinary life, as people lead it nowadays, in Asia, in European, and in American civilization, it is not possible to become a human being. You get up in the morning, eat breakfast, then you go about some task that maintains your position in the social order. Then you have lunch, or you receive guests, and talk about things which really do not need to be talked about, and the only purpose of which is to move your lips, so that they have something to do. Then you go for a walk with your guests and do whatever else it is you do nowadays. You cannot become a human being in such a social context. I am not relating this word for word. It is just a characterization. Thus, if you want to become a human being, you will have to try a different way of living. So, now the hero, to use the old aesthetic style of referring to them, attempts to find a new way by applying to a monastery. He is told that this is an extremely difficult path. I will not go into details here, but only point out what is important for us today. He is told that it is a difficult path, and that above all he must be aware that he will have to go through 3 stages of cognition. In the first stage of cognition, he will have to become clear about the position of the human being in relation to the world, insofar as this position is part of the human ego itself. So, this life in the ego and the quest to overcome the ego is the first stage of cognition. After having begun, in a sense, to peel off the ego, the second level of world cognition would consist of no longer seeing the world from the point of view of his own advantage, as he had done before he began to peel off the ego. The third stage would be that he would really understand the world and reality, and not as someone does who lives in their ego. He is told all this. And he is warned not to be too vehement in this striving to become a human being. He is warned of the difficulties he will face. But he does not give up. So, then he is allowed to enter the order. I only want to touch on the essentials. The initiation consists of him being alone in the night in a room where only one monk keeps watch over him. And there, at first he is lost in thought, but then he falls asleep. And after a short time he believes he has woken up. And now he finds himself in a room, on one wall of which is a mirror. He sees himself in this mirror and is astounded at what this means. What it means is that when a person orders their thoughts and reaches a strong decision, such as he has done, and then looks at their own mirror image, they will see themselves differently. We are shown that the hero is just beginning to see himself. The mirror image looks like him, but somehow different. And then he does what must follow such an astonishing experience and smashes the mirror, believing that he has injured himself. But then, out of the shards, he finds himself confronted by the mirror man, who is both himself and, in another way, is not himself. Now this person has attained the first level of cognition. He must get used to not only being in the world as an ego person, however, without ego consciousness, but to being in the world accompanied by the mirror man, which he is and also is not. Now this mirror man, who leads him on to all kinds of deeds in the outer world, is the embodiment of the encounter with the phenomena of the world and his own deeds in a completely new way, the confrontation with his own ego. Now, I will not go into great detail. In reality, the person concerned is actually still lying in bed, but is going through all that he is able to go through according to his previous experiences of life in the outside world and his own deeds in it. This is not always pleasant. However, how someone describes it depends on their own personal taste. In the way the author describes it, we can see what he thinks of it. Each person experiences events in the world in their own way, so we are guided through the events of the world. Just as Mephisto is the driving force in title Faust, so this mirror man is here the driving force, and the protagonist is led from one incident to the next, and in some cases, to do wrong. Everything appears to him in a new light, because he has looked in the mirror and seen himself. He sees all sorts of things in the world. Sometimes he sees things as they appear to him as an ego person, and sometimes as they appear to him who has faced himself in the mirror. He continues to experience the world, and in so doing leaves his ego evermore behind. The mirror man, who is at first quite thin, grows fatter and fatter. This is a polar parallel phenomenon, which is quite well described. And so this person lives on in the world, and now that he has confronted his own ego, he experiences what he would have experienced before in a completely different way. In the end, he is so involved with events in the world that he becomes his own judge and sentences himself to death. Again, this is characteristic. He discovers that he cannot really live in the world. When he entered the monastery, he was already aware that it is not possible to live in modern society if you want to become a human being. Now, this has escalated to the point where he has become his own judge and has condemned himself to death. And now he wakes up. In a sense, he wakes up at the moment of his death sentence. He is still in the same room. Now he looks at the mirror. However, as he does this, he notices that the mirror does not reflect a procession of monks who are just passing. Previously, when he looked in the mirror, it showed him himself and all else in front of it. But now a procession of monks is passing by, and they are not reflected. Now he notices that he is not standing in front of a mirror, but that the mirror has become a window. He is looking through it and out into the world, into the countryside. He has attained a third level of cognition. After having seen only what the mirror offers, now he sees the whole world. By having had the mirror man at his side, he saw what he had seen before, but in a different way. Now, however, he is looking, in a sense, through the surface of things, this is how it is described, and into free reality. And, of course, it is hinted at that now he is seeing spiritual reality. So here we have a trilogy. The first part is the mirror. The third is, let us say, the window. The mirror has become a window. Here are two worldviews which are polar opposites to one another. At first, each person sees in the other person their own mirror image, sees in the other only what they have in themselves. When they are trapped in their ego, they can only see in the next person or in some aspect of nature their own mirror image. At the end, when they have broken through the mirror, they no longer see their reflection but see through the surface of things and to the spiritual. And in between, there is this stage where they both flow into each other. Number one, the mirror. Number two, one flows into the other. Number three, the window. Now, I would like to point out two characteristics of this drama. The first is that we see the author's desire to depict a person rising up to a certain religious connection with another world. We can forgive the fact that the first part with the mirror is quite short, because it is interesting to see how the person finds their way into a vision of their own ego, so that this ego becomes so real that it accompanies them through the world. The middle part is more extensive, and the author describes a number of experiences. To find this appealing, you have to have a taste for it or not, as is the case. But as I said before, each person has to take it according to their personal taste. In any case, this part, where the protagonist is looking into his experiences in the world, is rather long. The third part is quite short, and what he sees outside is in a way only hinted at symbolically by looking through the window. It is not really described any further. As I said, it is quite short. This is the one characteristic I would like to bring out. The other is that we have to recognize that here someone is striving in the nicest way to bring some juice, some power, into thinking. And we see that a modern human being, such as Werfel, is not able to do so. Why not? That is rather strange. I have to say I read this drama with great interest, because it seems to me symptomatic for our present intellectual life as represented by various individuals. But when I had finished reading, I had to say to myself, the progression is firstly the mirror, secondly one flows into the other, then thirdly the window. However, we could just as well reverse the order and read it from back to front. And why? Because it is quite possible that we look at it in another way. And then we could say that a person's attitude toward the world determines how things appear to them. The person is no different than the phenomena. They have not woken up to ego consciousness. So our protagonist stands at the window and looks out into the world. Now he is turned for help to the old monk, unable to stand any longer, always just looking at things through the window. He wants to find himself. We could say that the old monk tells him that he will have to go through three stages of perception. The first one is the world, but we cannot find ourselves, our ego, in it. We lose ourselves in the world. The second stage is when we are just developing our ego, and we see in the world a great multitude of beings. The world comes alive, becomes spiritualized. Before, we saw it without spirit. Now it becomes full of spirits. Everywhere, in every being, plant, animal, cloud, and so on, we see something spiritual. Numerous spiritual beings appear before us in this second stage of cognition. In the third stage, we wake up. We go to the window and look out. We see everything anew. We see the real world for the first time. The window has turned into a mirror. The human being has become conscious. We encompass all these mirror beings, which appear to us in the world as plants, animals, clouds, and so on, within ourselves. In us, they become our own self, that has now become cosmic. And so by perceiving our true selves, we first perceive the cosmos. So we could rewrite the whole thing from back to front, the last part of the trilogy first, then the middle part, then the part with which it began. This is extremely interesting, because it is exactly this which makes this drama so typical of our present age. What is so typical of intellectualism? It is typical of intellectualism that you can start your thinking at any point and end it at any point as well, quite arbitrarily. You can argue in one direction and then in the other. I have often pointed this out. With thinking, you can prove anything or disprove anything. Intellectualism is nothing but a system of feeble, impotent thoughts, which lets you start anywhere, move along to a certain point, and then finish. However, we could just as well start at the point where we finished and move in the opposite direction. Nowadays, you can be quite an intelligent person and at the same time the crassest of materialists, because it is relatively easy to prove materialism. And if you are merely an intellectual, then you can wage war intellectually from the point of view of monism against the spirit, as happened after a meeting in the wake of the Anthroposophic Congress in Vienna. You can easily prove that materialism is right. You can just as well be a spiritualist and easily prove that too. As long as you stick to the intellectual, you can prove all these things, and all these intellectual discussions appear to be completely conclusive. This is the way it is in our times. People really have no idea how they weave a reality out of spiritualism, materialism, realism, idealism, and how they are deluding themselves with this intellectual spirit. They think, and rightly so, we can prove all this conclusively. They are creatures of materialism. And because it is true that we can prove all this conclusively, it becomes very bleak when we are forced to seriously discuss some aspect of reality, and then to open the debate for general discussion. Then one person says this, another that, the third something else. Basically, if we are even only slightly awake, we can say that they are all right. By the same token, they are also all wrong. All this chatter really only has one function, that perhaps one person or other notices how we are all deceiving ourselves by relying on intellectualism, because we can prove absolutely anything with it. It is just a question of settling into a particular belief or orientation, a sect or a party, for example. And then you can say with complete conviction that it is all perfectly clear, and anyone who thinks differently is an ass. Yes, but another person can just as well prove that the first one is an ass and they themselves are right. This is quite possible today, for intellectual life has reached the point where such things are completely normal. And so it is also completely normal for someone to write such a piece without coming anywhere near any real spiritual knowledge. Werfel shows us that he comes nowhere near real spirituality by the fact that nothing of real value is seen through the window. Spiritual knowledge would begin there where something significant is seen through the window. Only the three stages are depicted, and then our protagonist awakes and looks out. But what he sees is not described. So that even after having made so many concessions to ordinary consciousness and actually writing this title, Mirror Man, the author stalls when he could really get to the point and reveal something of importance. And for example, when confronted with my title, Knowledge of the Higher Worlds, How is it Achieved? Or title, Occult Science and Outline. Then all people can say is that if you really believe in such things, then you are not in your right mind. So that if all we can allow is that the protagonist has arrived at the window, but we will be careful not to let him see anything through it, then we are not ready to truly enter into spiritual life. Then we are really completely stuck in intellectualism. This is why it is possible for me to say these things. Obviously, it is not legitimate to criticize a work of art from a philosophical point of view. However, my critique is not philosophical. What I have said is from an artistic viewpoint. Because what happens is that you read the trilogy with great interest, but at the end of it, everything is upside down. This is an uncomfortable feeling. So in order to get back on your feet, you would have to rewrite the whole story from back to front. It would take quite a while to work your way back onto your feet. In fact, it becomes absolutely clear that we are being cheated artistically, that behind this story the wheel of intellectualism is turning. A real work of art makes a different impression. A real work of art cannot be turned around. Just try to rewrite Goethe's Faust from back to front. You cannot do it. A work of art cannot be turned backward. You can do it with this trilogy because the intellectualistic aspect dominates. It falls short of attaining a real vision. Now, intellectualism has the vague, indeterminate feeling that thinking needs more juice and vitality. But in reality, it completely lacks juice and vitality. It is empty. There is only a kind of formula of a real inner experience. And so from this example, which shows us what the spirit of our times produces, we can see where the true path lies. For 50 years now, people have had the feeling that we have to move toward the spiritual, but they want to avoid the real path. They take up all sorts of old traditions, such as the threefold path and so on. This threefold path is quite typical these days. You can find it in all kinds of books describing the old paths of atavistic clairvoyance. As long as they forego any presentation of what you can see through the window, the story can easily describe the mirror, the one flowing into the other, and then the window, and be a part of the intellectual life of the times. It is quite easy to describe if you only use these general terms. However, if we just stop there, we will never overcome this intellectualism, which has for so long fascinated modern society. I have often pointed out this intellectualistic element in various contexts. For example, when you go into some branch office of the Theosophical Society and find diagrams of all sorts of things hanging up, cultures, rounds, whole world systems, all sorts of wonderful intellectual constructions, all completely intellectualistic. And when they want to describe the structuring of the human being, there is a diagram. Physical human being, dense physical matter. Etheric body, finer matter. Astral body, even finer. Kama manas, even finer. Manas, even finer, finer, and finer. But all only grasped with the intellect. This finer, finer, and finer has no end. But it is all just intellectualistic. Just as we can keep on turning a wheel, when we stick to the intellectualistic, we can keep making matter ever thinner and thinner, and so we had an intellectualistic theosophy. And here we have an intellectualistic piece of fiction, which even goes as far as mysticism, celebrated by many of our contemporaries, and rightly so. Because we can see in it the state of the search for the spiritual in our times. My assessment is not unartistic. I look at the mirror man who accompanies the hero through all his evolution. And this mirror man is something completely different from what we see in Mephisto toward Faust. There is life in Faust. As you know, I have described how Mephisto is ultimately the other side of Faust, just as Wagner is. Quote, thou art like the spirit thou dost know, not me, close quote. You are like Wagner, you are like Mephisto, and so on. But here there is life. There is no life when the self jumps out of the mirror, at first thin, then ever plumper and plumper as the hero's life diminishes. The unalive, the abstract, in other words, is what dominates this work from beginning to end. The abstract can always be turned on its head. And since we find no artistic vision, intense and full of juice, but only thought templates exaggerated into images, we sense something unartistic. And it is curious that such things are often defended by people, saying that anthroposophy is just a striving for ideas and therefore unartistic. In reality, anthroposophy strives for real vision. Only, of course, people have to be ready for such a vision. We have to look through the window and see something. Here people are calling something artistic, which has not really hatched. Something just on the verge of being hatched, but which then prefers to remain inside the egg. You will understand what I mean with this image of the chicken which does not really want to come out of the egg and live in the world. It is as if a person wants to go down the path of knowledge, but to avoid the spiritual world in all its actuality and realness. I will refrain from describing how the egg feels when the chicken does not hatch properly, but this is a fair description of what such minds produce when they refuse to see reality and hatch properly. I do not intend to detract from the value of such works in any way. In this title, Mirror Man, I see something of great worth for our present times. However, something like this has to be characterized from a higher point of view, so that it can be situated accordingly in contemporary intellectual life, in contemporary cultural life, as I have here tried to do. The end of Lecture 12.